Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy B. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
This is part 2 of our episode on Irving Berlin, which I did not intend to have as a 2-parter, but that's what happened. If you start with this episode and you skip the first one, you're going to be missing more than 3 decades of his life, plus just a lot of context about the music industry in the United States in the first half of the 20th century. Also, Irving Berlin was really prolific, and so we cannot possibly mention every single song or even every single show that he worked on. So if you have a favorite that just doesn't come up, we're sorry. It's just not possible to do all of it. Also, as a heads up, we are going to talk about the death of an infant in this episode in more than just a passing reference to a baby who died.
In 1924, Irving Berlin met Ellen Mackey. He was 36, and she was the 21-year-old daughter of financier Clarence Mackey. Clarence did not approve of this relationship. In addition to the gap in their ages, Irving was Jewish and the Mackeys were Catholic. When Irving sought their blessing to propose, Ellen's mother gave it, but her father arranged for Ellen to take a prolonged trip in an effort to separate them. Berlin was famous, and the Mackeys were rich, so all of this was kind of big news, with reporters focused on their seemingly star-crossed relationship and Clarence's objection to it.
As all of this was going on, Berlin wrote a musical for the Marx Brothers, that was The Coconuts. Berlin wrote the music and the lyrics while George S. Kaufman wrote the book. This show was set in a hotel in Florida during its 1920s land boom. Groucho Marx played the role of the hotel proprietor, with Zeppo his assistant. Chico and Harpo were con men trying to rob the place. There were also other characters, including another con man. Although this show was really a lot more about the comedic sort of chaos that the Marx Brothers were known for more than for the actual plot.
It's kind of any Marx Brothers property, right? This is a movie, but really it's about poking each other in the eyes.
That's correct.
The Coconuts ran for 2 years on Broadway, followed by a tour and then a film. Although the Marx Brothers hated the film so much when they saw it that they tried to buy it back and keep it from being released. It was released over their objections and was generally well reviewed, and it was a big financial success.
On January 4th, 1926, Irving Berlin and Ellen Mackey got married at City Hall in New York. Ellen's family did not know this was happening. The witnesses for the couple were Irving's longtime friend and colleague, Max Winslow, and his wife, as well as Irving's publicity manager. When Ellen's father found out about this, he was furious. He cut her out of her inheritance, except for a trust that he could not legally touch. Ellen and her father did not speak to one another for the next 3 years.
Irving and Ellen's first child was born on November 25th, 1926. They named her Mary Ellen. And how to raise her and any other children they might have was the first big fight of Irving and Ellen's marriage. Specifically, they argued about whether to raise the children Jewish or Catholic. Ultimately, they decided on raising them as Jewish, but teaching them about Catholicism when they got a little older, and then allowing them to decide for themselves how they wanted to live. Various accounts of their home life describe incorporating elements from both traditions, like having both a Hanukkah menorah and a Christmas tree around those holidays.
Yeah, Mary Ellen, I think, is the one who wrote a memoir later on and described all of the holidays as being very important in their household. Christmas, though, quickly became a sad holiday for the family. Irving and Ellen had a son, Irving Berlin Jr., in 1928, but he died at the age of only 4 weeks. He was found dead in his crib on Christmas morning. The term sudden infant death syndrome was not coined until 1969, but it really describes what happened to Irving Jr. He died unexpectedly with no other explanation for what happened. The tragic loss of Irving Jr. is what finally led Clarence Mackey to reconcile with his daughter.
Aside from their grief over the loss of their son, Irving and Ellen struggled in some other ways as well. It's very, very clear that they loved each other deeply, but Irving had trouble writing music with newborns and toddlers in the house, and his nighttime hours did not line up with his family's needs. And also, while he considered himself to be pretty active, he quickly got a sense that becoming a parent at 40 was a lot different from becoming a parent at 20 or even 30 would have been.
The film The Jazz Singer debuted in 1927, which marked the start of the shift in the film industry from silent films to talkies, and Irving started doing more work for movies. That meant that he often needed to be in Hollywood, and he and Ellen had to figure out whether to move the family back and forth or whether to keep the children in New York, where, in the Berlins' opinion, they had better schools and a stronger community. They made it work, though, and over the years, they had two more children, Linda Louise in 1932 and Elizabeth Irving in 1936.
Of course, this also means that their family was growing during the Great Depression, which was at its worst from 1929 to 1933, but it continued to have economic effects for years afterwards. By starting his own publishing house and owning the rights to a lot of the music he'd written, Berlin's income was protected in the long term, but in the short term, he lost a lot of his savings and investments. Ellen's trust was not invested in the stock market and was mostly protected, so the family still had enough money to live on, but Irving really hated the fact that they were having to rely almost entirely on his wife's money. Ellen's father also lost most of his fortune in the stock market collapse.
The Depression also affected all the industries that he was trying to work in. Watterson, Berlin, and Snyder went bankrupt in 1929. In 1930, Berlin wrote a score for a film called Reaching for the Moon, but in the face of spiraling financial costs and personality conflicts and the financial impact of the Great Depression, United Artists made big changes to this movie that included cutting out most of Berlin's work. Berlin tended to take criticism and rejection pretty personally for his whole career, and that was the case here. Even though these cuts really do seem to have been more about money, maybe a little more about personality conflicts, not about the quality of the work that he had written, he became really depressed, and he struggled to regain his confidence afterward.
Although times were tight, Berlin did have some success during the Great Depression. In 1933, he wrote a review called As Thousands Cheer. Two of his better-known songs were written for this show, Easter Parade and Heat Wave. There were also satirical sketches based on real-world figures, many of whom have been covered on our podcast, including Amy Simple McPherson, John D. Rockefeller, and Josephine Baker.
Act two of this show began with an anti-lynching song called Supper Time, sung by Ethel Waters, who also sang three other songs in the show. This was the first time on Broadway that a Black performer was given equal billing with white co-stars, and there were people who saw this as a problem. Both the content of the song Supper Time and the expectations that white performers treat Waters as their equal. Three of her white co-stars refused to take a bow with her at the end of the show, and Irving Berlin's response to that was, in that case, there need be no bows at all. They did have bows. He basically forced her colleagues to treat her as equal to them.
I would love it if she got the only one, but that's just me.
That also, sure, would have been great.
This show was an enormous success, running for 400 performances at Berlin's Music Box Theater, followed by a tour, and Easter Parade was a big seller as sheet music. This really helped Irving Berlin start to recover financially in the later years of the Depression.
On May 28, 1934, Irving Berlin was on the cover of Time magazine with the descriptor, quote, Jerome Kern was reminded of Wagner. So Jerome Kern was a composer and a songwriter whose work included Old Man River and The Way You Look Tonight and the music for the musical Showboat. Kern had made this comment about Irving Berlin reminding him of Wagner a decade prior. But by 1934, this had become a pretty jarring comparison. Wagner was deeply anti-Semitic, and Wagner had earned vocal praise from Adolf Hitler, who by this point was ruling Germany as a dictator.
We are coming up on one of Irving Berlin's most famous songs, and eventually to World War II, and we will get to all of that after a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. In the 1930s, a lot of Irving Berlin's work was in film, including the movie Top Hat with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers in 1935. This was the start of a long friendship between Irving and Astaire, and in 1936, Irving was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song for the song Cheek to Cheek. This Oscar wound up going to Lullaby of Broadway from the movie Gold Diggers, and Irving Berlin thought that was a pretty big insult.
In 1937, the Berlin family planned a vacation to Alaska. This was a trip that involved a cruise. This trip was long enough that Berlin needed to be able to keep working, so he planned to take his transposing piano with him. This presented a problem when it turned out that his transposing piano would not fit on the ship. He was informed that any size grand piano would work as long as the legs were removed to get it on board. So he made do with that.
I just find that story just delightful. Like,
wild.
Weird, yes. The musical film Alexander's Ragtime Band came out in 1938, and it was named after Berlin's hit song from 1911 that we talked about in part one. Berlin wrote the script in collaboration with Catherine Scola, Lamar Trotti, and Richard Sherman, and it included several of his most popular songs. In this film, Alexander is a band leader who wants to make people think of ragtime as a more legitimate style of music, and through his story, the music gives a general history of the musical styles of ragtime and jazz. This movie was pretty well reviewed. But this is also a movie that was about the history of ragtime and jazz, which are two musical styles that were developed by Black people that did not include any Black people. I haven't seen this movie, but looking at cast lists, like, I think not at all. Like, not even in, like, a background role. None.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. This film also faced allegations of plagiarism. Marie Cooper Dyckhouse filed suit against both Berlin and 20th Century Fox, alleging that the plot was the same as her unpublished novel, Love Girl. She had submitted this novel to agents and filmmakers in Hollywood the year before the movie was made. This legal case went on for years, with a judge ruling that the movie's plot was the same as the book in 1944. But 2 years later, this was overturned because there was no evidence that Berlin or any of the other screenwriters involved had ever seen the novel and that none of them knew any of the literary agents that the book had been submitted to.
While the earlier ruling had focused on similarities between the book and the movie, the ruling in the appeal noted some key differences. Quote, "The book is laid in part in the same period as the picture, but it is about the loves of the love girl and her several lovers, and there is no note of music in it. The picture's real interest and value as to every scene and action in it are in the music. Its presentation requires 1 hour and 3/4, and each minute is filled with action attuned to the music."
To return to 1938, one of Irving Berlin's most famous songs made its debut that Armistice Day that year. That was November 11th, commemorating the armistice at the end of World War I. Of course, by this point, parts of the world were at war again, and tensions were escalating in others. The Second Sino-Japanese War had started in July of 1937, and Germany had annexed Austria in March of 1938. That September, Germany, Italy, Great Britain, and France had signed the Munich Agreement, forcing Czechoslovakia to cede its predominantly German-speaking border region to Germany. This was done under threat of war with Germany and without the involvement of Czechoslovakia.
In the face of all of this, Kate Smith had asked Irving Berlin for a new song for her Armistice Day performance, one that wound up taking place the day after the November pogrom, also known as Kristallnacht, which took place over November 9th and 10th of 1938. We covered this pogrom on the podcast in 2018. The song that Berlin gave her was God Bless America, which he'd originally worked on to include in Yip Yip Yap Hank, but had not been satisfied with at that time. One lyric that he changed as he was working on this for Kate Smith was "Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above." "Through the night" was originally "to the right," meaning toward what was right, but he made the change out of concerns that people would interpret "right" as instead having a political meaning.
This song was an immediate hit, becoming one of Kate Smith's signature songs. It got huge amounts of radio play, and its sheet music became a bestseller. People called for God Bless America to be made the national anthem and replace the Star-Spangled Banner that had been adopted just 7 years prior. Among other things, like many of Berlin's songs, God Bless America was much easier to sing. But this song also faced an anti-Semitic, xenophobic backlash, as people questioned how a Jewish immigrant had the right to call on God to bless the United States. The Ku Klux Klan called for a boycott.
Others disliked this song for different reasons, including folk singer and songwriter Woody Guthrie. Guthrie found the song to be too uncritically patriotic and too optimistic, especially given the state of the world and how many people were still financially really struggling in the wake of the Great Depression. This is also one of those songs that was just on the radio constantly. I know we've all had that song just on the radio constantly. We just are so sick of it. Guthrie felt like it was impossible to get away from God Bless America. So in 1940, he wrote a song of his own, and that song was This Land Is Your Land, which followed the same basic tune as two different Carter Family songs. Those songs were When the World's on Fire, which came out in 1930, and Little Darling Pal of Mine, which came out in 1935. Guthrie performed this song a lot, as did Pete Seeger, who has come up on the show recently.
One of the ironies about all of this is that Guthrie's criticism of God Bless America included what he saw as its uncritical elevation of the United States. But he wound up cutting out the most critical verses of This Land Is Your Land in most early recordings and sheet music printings. One verse that was usually cut was, "As I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me." Another was, "In the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office I seen my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me?" The verses that were left, meaning the ones that people became most familiar with, were mostly the happier ones, about endless skyways and golden valleys and diamond deserts and wheat fields waving, not especially critical.
Also, Woody Guthrie was a white man from Oklahoma writing a song about this land is my land. So sure, God Bless America can come across as a glorification of American exceptionalism. That's a fair point, Woody Guthrie. But also, This Land Is Your Land can really read like a tribute to settler colonialism.
But to return to Irving Berlin, toward the end of the 1930s, he bought a place in the Catskills that needed a lot of fixing up, and he had it renovated so the family could spend their summers there. In 1940, he set up a trust to divert all of the royalties from God Bless America to the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts.
In 1940, Irving Berlin finished writing one of his biggest hits, and that was the song White Christmas. Soon, he was also working on a movie to put it in. That movie was Holiday Inn. When he talked to producers and executives about this movie in the works, he said he already had a big song for it, which needed to be included in the contract for the film. The first public radio broadcast of White Christmas was on Christmas Eve 1941 on Bing Crosby's weekly radio program, and this was just weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. White Christmas can sound like a really wistful or even sad song, depending on how it's performed, and that's been interpreted as tracing back to the death of his infant son on Christmas of 1928.
The movie Holiday Inn came out in 1942, starring Bing Crosby, Fred Astaire, Marjorie Reynolds, Virginia Dale, and Walter Abel. In addition to making sure White Christmas was included in plans for the film, Berlin had also worked to make sure Bing Crosby was cast in it. In 1943, the song White Christmas won the Academy Award for Best Original Song. This movie came out in August, and Berlin had planned to start marketing the sheet music for White Christmas closer to Christmas, but it became an immediate bestseller with 600,000 copies sold by November of that year.
Holiday Inn also caused some controversy. One of its musical numbers is called Abraham, and in the context of the movie, it's a song that's meant to be performed on Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and it is also a blackface minstrel number. Berlin was also criticized for some of this song's lyrics, specifically the use of one adjective that Black audiences found offensive. I don't feel like we need to repeat what that adjective was in the show. A Baltimore newspaper called the African American called Berlin out on this. And in response, he changed the lyric in future printings of the sheet music, saying, quote, "No song is important enough to offend a whole race. I should never have released it had I known the epithet was objectionable."
This was not Irving Berlin's last controversy about how he approached race in his work. And we're going to talk more about that after we take a quick little sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. In December of 1941, the War Department asked Irving Berlin to work on a patriotic military musical along the same lines of Yip Yip Yap Hank during World War I. That would be performed to raise funds and also to raise the morale of the troops. And the result of that request was This Is the Army. That is an effort that was simultaneously progressive and regressive in terms of race.
In terms of its progressiveness, Berlin insisted on casting Black performers for this show at a time when the U.S. Army was racially segregated. The Army would continue to be racially segregated until President Harry Truman issued Executive Order 9981 in 1948. This was the only racially integrated uniformed army unit in the Second World War, and that was because Irving Berlin had demanded it. Berlin also pressured theaters where the show was being performed to integrate. The same newspaper that had criticized his language in Holiday Inn published a piece titled "Irving Berlin Cracks DC's Jim Crow Law After He Forced a Washington, D.C. Theater to Admit a Black Woman Who Bought a Ticket."
However, he also had a huge argument with director Ezra Stone about the show's opener, which Berlin envisioned as involving the entire cast of 110 men in blackface. Stone told him, quote, "I know the heritage of the minstrel show. Those days are gone. People don't do that anymore." But Berlin continued to insist that this was how the show should start. Stone only got him to change his plans by pointing out the practical issue of getting 110 performers out of their blackface makeup for the rest of the show. But Berlin still insisted on having a different number with a smaller group of performers in blackface later on.
Berlin's conflicts with Stone and others during this show did not end there. There was a lot of haggling over money, with Berlin's financial manager, Saul Bornstein, horrified at Berlin's plans to donate all of his proceeds from the music sales. There was some unfortunate back and forth between Berlin, Stone, and others about whether there were too many Jewish people in the cast, something that seems particularly jarring considering that Berlin himself was Jewish. But there were several overlapping factors here. Berlin was concerned about increasing anti-Semitism in the U.S. and abroad, and about whether having a predominantly Jewish cast would lead to rumors that they were in the show to try to get out of combat duty.
One particular tour performance left Berlin feeling like Stone had intentionally insulted him. Normally, at the end of the show, Berlin would come out from the wings and Stone would order the cast to face left where Berlin was standing. But when they performed in Washington, D.C., President Roosevelt was in a box to the right, so Stone ordered them to face that way. That meant that the entire cast turned their backs to Berlin in front of the president. He was very upset about this, but it also seems like if they had done the opposite, that would have involved a whole bunch of military men in uniform simultaneously turning their backs on the president, and that seems like it would have caused a different problem. Like, the only correct thing to do with the show would have been to realize what was going on and change the blocking totally differently ahead of time, and that's not what happened.
Or either just say, hey, we have to turn this way. Make it look like you're joining the cast to face the president. There are solutions here.
Smart. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
This is the army toured in the U.S. as well as in Europe and North Africa, and it was eventually made into a movie. Berlin was with the touring cast whenever he could be. At various points, he had to leave for both personal reasons and for other commitments. While they were in London, he met Prime Minister Winston Churchill, although there is an oft-repeated story that this invitation was an error and that Churchill thought he would be meeting philosopher and historian Isaiah Berlin. Irving Berlin rejoined the tour for its final performance in 1945, gave a final stage performance of Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning, and said that he hoped he'd never have to write another war song.
This is the Army raised more than $6 million for the Army Emergency Relief Fund. I saw some numbers that were even higher than that. And in 1945, President Harry Truman awarded Berlin the Medal of Merit for his efforts on it. In 1944, the National Conference of Christians and Jews honored Berlin for, quote, advancing the aims of the conference to eliminate religious and racial conflict. I feel like the idea of racial conflict here, it's like very, he seems to have been all over the place on this issue and generally much better at how he worked with individual performers than like broad issues like not doing blackface anymore.
Yeah, it seems like some part of him wanted to do the correct thing, but he just kept stepping in it. Like,
yeah,
problematic. Toward the end of the war, Berlin ended his business relationship with Saul Bornstein. It wasn't just because of the conflict over Berlin wanting to donate his royalties, but also because their working relationship had really been deteriorating for years. And Berlin had evidence that Bornstein had been stealing from him. Berlin never discussed this publicly, and he never pressed any charges. It seems like he had clear evidence of wrongdoing, but since Bornstein's actions hadn't caused the business to fail or meaningfully harmed Berlin, he had still become wealthy through its songwriting. He just wanted this whole incident to be over with and quietly.
During and after World War II, there was a shift in the kind of shows that were popular on Broadway, moving from things like musical revues and vaudeville shows that had, at most, a very thin suggestion of a plot kind of holding a bunch of songs together, to instead a more narrative form of musical storytelling. These kinds of narrative musicals definitely existed before the war, but they became a lot popular afterward, and this was especially true following the success of Oklahoma, which was the first musical written by the duo of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II.
Berlin's first foray into writing for this kind of musical was Annie Get Your Gun in 1946, which was about Annie Oakley. This was something Dorothy Fields had been working on with Rodgers and Hammerstein as producers. The plan was for Fields to write the lyrics and for Jerome Kern to write the music, with the spectacular, that's my interjection, Ethel Merman in the lead role. But then Kern unexpectedly died of a stroke. This was a personal and professional loss for many, including Irving Berlin, who was also upset by the realization that Kern was only 3 years older than he was when he died.
The team approached Berlin about taking Kern's place, which he was willing to do only if he also took Fields' place as lyricist. Fields seems to have felt like she had enough to do on the show without doing the lyrics. It doesn't seem like she felt she was being forced out in this change, but even after she had stepped aside, Berlin still really had to be convinced to take the job. He had some trepidation about joining a show that he hadn't been part of from the start. By this point, a lot of his other shows were basically marketed with his name at the beginning, like Irving Berlin's whatever. He also just wasn't sure how well he would do at writing this kind of material.
As many creative ventures are, this seems to have been chaotic and stressful, but it was also another success. The show opened in May of 1946, and it ran for 1,147 performances, and it was later made into a film. Berlin would later say of writing for Ethel Merman, quote, "I love to write songs for Ethel. It's a little like a dress designer getting an extra kick when he dreams up a gown for a beautiful woman with a perfect figure."
Irving Berlin continued to do both creative and philanthropic work from there. In 1948, during the Berlin airlift, Irving Berlin traveled to West Berlin with past podcast subject Bob Hope to perform for the troops who were involved with that effort. In 1949, he wrote the music and lyrics for a musical called Miss Liberty, which included setting Emma Lazarus's poem The New Colossus to music. Emma Lazarus and that poem, also a past episode of the podcast. This musical was not a success, though. It ran for 308 performances, but it was badly reviewed, and a touring show lost money.
After this, Irving Berlin became increasingly depressed. His oldest daughter got a divorce that year, something that was widely covered in the press, and she blamed herself for her father's mental illness, feeling like it was because she had let him down. He started to recover somewhat when he started working on another show for Ethel Merman, this one called Call Me Madam, which opened in 1950. But he continued to experience periods of depression and anxiety, and at times he had to be hospitalized for treatment.
In 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower presented Irving Berlin with a Congressional Gold Medal for God Bless America and other patriotic songs he had written. That same year, White Christmas became a movie starring Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Rosemary Clooney, and Vera Ellen. White Christmas is often described as a spiritual successor to Holiday Inn, although unlike Holiday Inn, it does not include a blackface number. It does, however, include a medley that sings about how much they love going to minstrel shows.
Yeah. You know. You got to take the good with the bad when you look at classic films, for sure, and think critically about what they're saying. In 1962, Berlin wrote his last full-length musical. That was Mr. President, about a fictional U.S. president's personal and political life. And like Miss Liberty, it was not a success. Overall, it was poorly reviewed, and it closed after a little more than 200 performances.
Yeah, I think they basically got through all of their advanced ticket sales, and then that was the end. This was not the note that Irving Berlin wanted to end his career on. He kept wanting to just write one more successful musical, or put together one last review at the Music Box Theater, or write one more hit song. In 1963, he received a Tony Award for, quote, his distinguished contribution to the musical theater for these many years, but this did not really lift his spirits. He increasingly felt obsolete and out of touch with changing musical tastes and probably social mores. Toward the end of his life, he said, quote, "It was as if I owned a store and people no longer wanted to buy what I had to sell. Music changed, too. the Beatles and other groups reached audiences I couldn't. It was time to close up shop.
And since he was in his 70s with a career that had started at the turn of the 20th century, many of his longtime friends, colleagues, and collaborators had died. He also outlived all of his siblings, the last of whom died in 1978. He had taken up painting, and he spent more of his time on that while becoming more reclusive and generally withdrawing from public life.
In 1970, Irving Berlin was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and in 1973, he gave his last public performance. This was at the White House, singing God Bless America for more than 500 American POWs from the Vietnam War. After retiring from writing and performing, Irving Berlin donated his transposing piano to the Smithsonian, and he donated his World War I military uniform to the Museum of American Jewish Military History.
In 1977, President Gerald Ford awarded Irving Berlin the Presidential Medal of Freedom, but he was not at the ceremony and no one represented him there. The same was true of two other honorees. One of those was Georgia O'Keeffe, and the other was Alexander Calder, who was awarded the medal posthumously.
When Irving Berlin turned 100 on May 11, 1988, a tribute concert was held in his honor at Carnegie Hall, although he did not personally attend. This concert was later aired as a television broadcast that won two Emmy Awards. This concert had a star-studded cast, including Frank Sinatra, Rosemary Clooney, Leonard Bernstein, Natalie Cole, Nell Carter, Jerry Orbach, Madeleine Kahn, Willie Nelson, Ray Charles, and Bea Arthur, among many others. Shirley MacLaine made a joke that they couldn't sing Happy Birthday because that was the one song he didn't write before she sang There's No Business Like Show Business. That was another song from the musical Annie Get Your Gun, and There's No Business Like Show Business also later became part of a movie musical by the same name.
A couple of months later, on July 29th, 1988, Irving Berlin's wife, Ellen Mackey Berlin, died. They had been married for 62 years. Irving had a stroke the day after Christmas that year, and he was not expected to survive, but he did recover. He died on September 22, 1989, at the age of 101.
Over the course of his career, he'd written more than 900 songs. I saw some totals that were much greater than that, and that seems a little low to me, honestly. He also wrote the music and lyrics for 19 musicals and the scores for 18 movies. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, Bing Crosby's recording of White Christmas is still the best-selling album of all time. One quote that comes up a lot in discussions of Irving Berlin's life and work is from Jerome Kern, who wrote it in a letter to biographer Alexander Wolcott in 1927. So this quote does not really reflect the complexities of his work that we've talked about in this episode, but it does really show how people regarded him in the early 20th century. Kern wrote, quote, "Irving Berlin has no place in American music. He is American music." As part of the same letter, he also said, quote, "He honestly absorbs the vibrations emanating from the people, manners, and life of his time, and in turn gives these impressions back to the world, simplified, clarified, glorified." I have a lot of feelings about Irving Berlin. He has a lot of songs that I love. I enjoy watching White Christmas at Christmas time, even though that movie has simultaneously aged beautifully and terribly.
Like, yeah, I tend to focus a lot on the clothes, and I'm like, that's, I acknowledge that that part's there, but that is not what this movie is about for me.
Yeah, yeah, I knew we were going to have to talk a lot about blackface in these two episodes, but I did not really realize that there was going to be a part where he was stridently defending the use of blackface and the people telling him, like, no, seriously,
no,
Irving,
dude,
we don't do this anymore.
Not cool.
So anyway, we'll talk some more about personal stuff and behind the scenes on Friday. I have listener mail from Jennifer. And Jennifer wrote, "Hey, Holly and Tracy, I love the podcast and have my PhD in SYMHC and have the shirt to prove it. I just finished listening to the episode on Charles Drew, which was great. At the end of the podcast, talking about the American Red Cross ban on donated blood from men who have sex with men triggered the memory for me that the Canadian Blood Services recently in April lifted the ban on these men from donating. They have instituted protocols to have this blood closely tested for HIV and other bloodborne illnesses. This is a great move forward for blood collection in Canada. And then there's a link to an article on this. Included with this email is a picture of my house panther, Batman, being a diva and having his picture taken. He is both handsome and very snuggly. Thank you for all the entertainment you provide, Jennifer. So that's correct. I did not know this, but the Canadian Blood Services did just change their policy in April on this. Their policy has still gotten some criticism. Like we were talking about in the behind the scenes on our Charles Drew episode, it is focused on behaviors instead of broadly banning all men who have sex with men and all people who may have had sex with a man who has had sex with a man, and instead looking at behaviors. But people have criticized that some of these behaviors still could be discriminatory. So while that's definitely a change that seems to be generally favorable, it is still one that people have had criticisms of. But thank you for letting us know about that, Jennifer. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. And we're all over social media at Missed in History. That's where you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.